The case calls to docket 13-19-0043-CV, Texas Department of Public Safety, and Stephen McGraw in his official capacity as Director of the Texas Department of Public Safety versus Maria Luisa Mejia Sunak individually and on behalf of the estate of Marcos Antonio Castro Estrada and as next a friend to LMHM Miners et al.
Thank you, Your Honor, and may it please the court. Your Honors, I'd like to be clear that DPS does not deny in any way the tragic deaths that occurred here, but the only question before this court is a legal one. Did the trial court err in denying the motion for summary judgment? And it did for three main reasons. First, the Tort Claims Act does not waive immunity for an intentional tort. Second, the officers are entitled to official immunity. And third, the trial court lacked jurisdiction to grant declaratory relief. And I'd like to address each of those three points in turn. First, because the shooting was an intentional tort, the Tort Claims Act does not waive DPS's sovereign immunity. And that makes intuitive sense in this case because it's undisputed that TFO Avila purposely aimed his weapon at the vehicle and purposely fired. It makes no difference that he was aiming at the vehicle rather than at the driver or the other occupants. In Castleman, the United States Supreme Court explained that even indirect force can give rise to a claim for battery. And the Fort Worth Court of Appeals applied that principle in Deal. In Deal, the officers deployed a tire deflation device, and the court held that that was an intentional tort, even though the force was applied to the tires rather than directly to the driver. So when TFO Avila purposely shot the vehicle, because the driver and the vehicle and the occupants are so closely connected, he was committing a battery, albeit a privileged one, against the driver. And through the well-established doctrine of transferred intent, he was also committing a battery against the
Mr. Heifel, I am, when you talk about the intentional tort, you make the direct to the intention of firing the gun and not as to whom or what direction the firing of the gun is. And that seems to be a huge differentiation. Yes, he intentionally fired the gun, but he did not intentionally want to fire the gun into these people that were in the trunk of the bed, which according to his own testimony, he did not know were in the trunk of the bed. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor. And the plaintiffs relying on the Durbin case argue that the difference between negligence and a battery is the intent to cause injury. And clearly there was no intent to cause injury here, but that's incorrect given the circumstances. In the Gordon case.
Well, in the handcuff case, which is the most current case that we have out of the Texas Supreme Court, where the claim was incident to an arrest, the Texas Supreme Court seems to base a lot of it as to the incident arrest. And that's not what we have here. Isn't that true?
You're correct, Your Honor, that we don't have the same exact situation as in Gordon. But what the court explained in Gordon is that in the context of the Tort Claims Act, when we're trying to distinguish negligence from an intentional tort, we don't just look to whether there was an intent to cause injury, because that's not an essential element of a battery. So here, what TFO Avila did intend to do was to cause a contact that an ordinary person would find to be offensive, namely having your vehicle shot. And so that was an intentional tort, even though he wasn't intending injury.
Would that argument be the same, Mr. Heifel, had the gun had a bystander, someone who was not in the truck, be shot at? Would then the argument still be the same, that it, since it's an intentional tort and it was a bystander that got shot, then it didn't matter that he did not intend to cause harm to someone in another vehicle nearby?
That's correct, Your Honor. It would not have made a difference if he were intending to cause offensive contact to this particular vehicle, if the bystander had happened to be in another vehicle rather than in the same vehicle. Transferred intent would still apply. Now, there could have been a situation that might have given rise to an alternative negligence claim here if there had been an alternative factual theory. So for example, if there was evidence that TFO Avila was handling his weapon carelessly, you know, he was just toying with it and it accidentally went off and shot one of the decedents, that might have given rise to a negligence claim. But here there was no alternative factual theory. It's undisputed that he purposely fired the weapon and purposely contacted the vehicle.
So let's talk about that purposeful contact that gave these officers the policy to shoot at this car. Is the procedure that they undertook, and you said it in quite detail in your brief, of everything they took into account in order to come to the decision as to whether to shoot at this vehicle or not, is that whole process also not something we need to review as to whether this is a waiver of immunity under the tort, their negligence action as to deciding to shoot the gun?
Your Honor, it's not. Courts have held that deciding whether to intentionally use force is subsumed within the act of intentionally using force. So for example, that's the Deal case. That's also Ryan versus Napier, which was a 2018 case from the Supreme Court of Arizona. But it is true that the court should consider what the officers knew at the time, not with the benefit of hindsight and further investigation. And one of the things that's peculiar about this case is that it's not a typical police pursuit case. And one of the reasons for that is that the DPS officers did not initiate this pursuit. It was the game wardens that initiated it. So the plaintiffs argue, well, all the driver did was fail to signal a turn. That doesn't justify the pursuit and everything that followed. But one of the problems with that argument is that the game wardens are not defendants in this case. The DPS officers were. So we have to focus on what they knew at the time. They knew that they had intercepted a request for help from the game wardens. They quickly arrived on the scene. They had probable cause to believe that the driver was committing not just a misdemeanor, but the felony offense of evading arrest with a motor vehicle. They saw the excessive speeds at which the driver was driving. And I know here the plaintiffs point to DPS speed calculations and they say, well, the driver was only traveling 50 or 60 or 70 miles per hour. But the court should consider that in the entire context. This was not an interstate highway. This was a two-lane dirt road. And if the court watches the video, the court will see for itself the excessive speeds. And in any event, the officers also saw the tarp or the blanket in the bed of the truck. And based on decades of combined experience, all three officers unanimously concluded that the vehicle was illegal drug. Based on those facts, as they knew them at the time, the decision to join the pursuit was reasonable. And moreover, the decision to attempt to disable the vehicle was reasonable. Here again, there's a difference from a typical police pursuit case because this pursuit did not conclude with an accident. It didn't conclude with an accidental collision. It included with an intentional tort. And so that affects the legal framework that we should apply. So in cases like
I'm going to, since you're running short on time, I want to address the second issue as to the official immunity of these officers before you run out of time. Can you address that issue, please?
Yes, Your Honor. And so, again, to decide whether the officers acted reasonably in this situation, we examine what the officers knew at the time. In addition to the factors that I've already mentioned, the officers were aware of the surroundings. TFO Avila actually testified that he is from this area. He's familiar with these roads and familiar with these towns. And he and the other officers knew that they were quickly approaching asphalt where the speed would increase. They were approaching residential areas and they were approaching school zones sometime after 3 o'clock in the afternoon. They knew that the game wardens were pursuing this vehicle. Even if they had backed off in the helicopter, the game wardens would have still been pursuing the driver. And at least one of the officers had personally been involved in a prior situation in which a smuggler had barreled through a school zone, had narrowly avoided missing several bystanders, and then had crashed into a house. So they were aware of the very real risks involved in this situation. Now, even if the court disagrees with the decision that they made, And even if the court concludes that they were negligent, for example, for not investigating further before attempting to disable the vehicle, the Texas Supreme Court has explained on multiple occasions, including in the Ballantyne case, that negligence does not defeat a claim to official immunity. Indeed, the very purpose of official immunity is to shield officers who would otherwise be liable. So even if the court concludes that they were negligent here, that doesn't defeat a finding of official
immunity. How is this case not similar to the Rangel case, where the Supreme Court found that the instructing the prison guards to use tear gas, gun, and scat shells during a riot was use of a tangible personal and waive sovereign immunity?
Your Honor, even if we assume that the DPS did use the helicopter and the rifle here, the claim still fails as a matter of law for at least two reasons. The first is that, as we've already mentioned, this arose from an intentional tort. In the Rangel case, the Texas Supreme Court explicitly declined to reach whether the intentional tort exception applied. Here, the court is confronted with that issue, and for the reasons we've already talked about, should conclude that it did.
And assuming that we, for the sake of argument this afternoon, that we find it was an intentional tort, just make that assumption with me, then do under Rangel, then is fits right in the four corners, and there is waiver under TTCA.
Your Honor, the claim would still fail because a claim of negligent entrustment requires some sort of incompetence or lack of qualification in the party that is receiving the property. That's the Goodyear case, for example, that we cite in our brief that provides the elements. Here, the record shows that Lieutenant Prince had been a DPS pilot for about 15 years before this incident and had, in fact, trained other pilots. The record also shows that TFO Avila had received regular training in the aerial use of force. So the record establishes that these officers were competent, they were qualified, licensed, trained, and there's no evidence in the record to negate those facts.
So you're saying that you know, if we agree with you that Avila's shooting of the pickup was a battery, we can't allow the appellees from pursuing a separate claim or alternative claims under negligence. For example, negligent entrustment or other claims that might be available to them under negligence.
That's correct, Your Honor. We can't have a separate claim for negligent entrustment. And again, even if the court disagrees and concludes that you could, there's still no showing of any kind of lack of competence or qualification here. And in addition, as we mentioned earlier, there's no separate causal theory here. There's no separate factual theory that could give rise to an independent claim for negligence.
Do we take into account, Mr. Heifel, that the policy of the department changed thereafter, so this is no longer allowed? And how do we take that evidence into account in our analysis of this case at this time?
Yes, Your Honor, that's certainly something that you can take into account, but a policy change is just that. It's a policy decision based on a number of factors. And just because a department changes its policy does not mean that the prior policy was per se unreasonable. Otherwise, departments wouldn't change their policy because they'd be liable for the actions under the prior policy. So what's important...
But can't we assume then if it's now a policy saying it's not permitted, this kind of conduct, that couldn't we assume that under the prior policy that it was permissible and therefore it wasn't an intentional tort? It was something that was, this conduct was allowed under the policy that existed at the time.
Your Honor, the conduct was allowed under the policy that existed at the time, but that doesn't mean that it wasn't an intentional tort. Again, we look to the elements of battery and we see an intentional causing of a contact that a reasonable person would find offensive.
But the conduct was to knock out the tires or to puncture the tires. There's no testimony that any of these officers intended to hit any of the drivers, but you can say that through transference or that they're it was just the mere act of hitting the vehicle that was sufficient. But they didn't even know these people were in, these third parties were in the vehicle. It wasn't like a bystander that you could say, okay, there's a possibility that if I shoot in that direction, there's other people kind of in the area. So therefore, at least there was some sort of knowledge that could be imputed. Here, the testimony is nobody knew those people were back there. So how is it intentional in regards to these third parties being shot or being the victim?
Your Honor, I see I'm out of time. May I answer the question?
Yes. You may.
So, Your Honor, you're correct that they had no knowledge that those individuals were there. And so the reasonableness of their decision depended on what they knew at the time. The choice that they were faced with was allowing the vehicle to continue on its course or attempting to disable it. They chose to disable it with the means that were available to them. And when they did so in as safe a way as possible. They waited till the vehicle was away from other vehicles. They waited till it was in an unpopulated area. And they initially focused on the rear tire to minimize the risk to the driver and the passenger, who were the only people that they knew were in the vehicle. So they did it in as safe a way as they knew how. And unless there are further questions, I'll reserve time for rebuttal.
Justice Tejerina, Justice Hinojosa? If not, you will have your 5 minute for rebuttal. Mr. Smith, whenever you're ready, let the clock get to 20, there it is. And you can proceed and the clock will proceed with you, Mr. Smith.
Yes, Your Honor. Thank you very much for this opportunity to talk with you guys today. I want to start off with talking about the requisite kind of intent, because the department seems to believe that an intentional tort in the context of the Texas Tort Claims Act is somehow different than an intentional tort in any other context in the state of Texas. And that is not true. The TTCA doesn't say, well, we've got a different class of intentional tort when we've got suits involving the government. And there's longstanding case law and principles that discuss how Texas applies the doctrines that define what constitutes an intentional tort and what does not. That's from Durbin and from cases as old as Kyle versus Kimball, cases that involve intentional tort exclusions and insurance policies. And the way that Texas has set up this framework is that we deal with causes of action on a spectrum, because every single cause of action that exists in the state has to involve some degree of an intentional act. When someone's driving down the street and they see a red light and they say, oh, I don't think anyone's here, I'm going to drive through it, and they miss somebody, and someone enters that intersection, they cause a collision. Driving through that red light is an intentional act, but no one defines that as a battery or assault. And so the way that Texas has set this up is that when you engage in conduct and there's a risk that's foreseeable, that's negligence. If you engage in conduct and there's a serious risk, we define that as gross negligence. If you engage in conduct where you intend an injury or you're substantially certain that an injury will occur, that's an intentional tort. And the example that's been used by the Texas Supreme Court that comes from Prosser is an individual who shoots into a crowd, hoping that he hits no one, but knowing that he will. He doesn't get to escape the battery or the assault by virtue of his hope, when he knows with substantial certainty that that bullet will hit somebody. And it is undisputed in this case that the officers who were in this helicopter did not intend and were not substantially certain that there were people in the bed of that truck who would be shot, injured, and killed by virtue of their conduct. His actions are not intentional torts with respect to the people who actually got hurt here. And what the department has to do in order to bridge the gap between the intent that did exist, the intent to try to shoot at the tires to disable the vehicle, and what actually happened, killing two people in the bed of that truck, is to take two different aspects of the doctrine of transferred intent and to put them together in a way that is completely novel. In City of Watauga versus Gordon, when the Texas Supreme Court says, when a police officer puts handcuffs on an arrestee, he intends an offensive contact with that individual. If he winds up causing a harmful contact, the intent to cause that harmful contact will be assumed. And there's cases from the criminal law where an individual shoots intending to wound or kill another person, but by virtue of bad aim, hits someone else. And in the criminal context, the doctrine of transfer intent comes in and says, your intent to kill one person that wound up killing somebody else, we'll assume that you intended to kill the third person that you actually hit. And the whole purpose behind that doctrine is to create a fiction that expands the range of culpability so that wrongdoers cannot escape the scrutiny of their conduct. And what the Texas Department of Public Safety does here is they say, well, we'll take these two things and we'll merge them together into something new. Where if I intend an offensive contact with one person, but I wind up killing somebody else, my intent to kill the third person will be assumed under the doctrine of transfer intent. And there's no case law that's cited in the appellate's brief or in their reply, and no case law that I can find that holds the doctrine of transferred intent can be distorted inside that, such fashion.
Mr. Smith, let me stop you there real quick. And I want to understand, you're talking about transferred intent and you've mentioned innocent bystanders, but do we characterize these people in the back as innocent bystanders if they're hiding themselves, knowing that they could be in a situation where they might get chased by police because they are somewhat conspirators with the drivers as well? They know that something bad could happen.
I think that the people who came into this country, who were coming here and getting into this truck, and, you know, the factual record is such that they were transported here and then pointed in a direction, and they went there, and then they were told to get in the bed of the truck and then cover the car, and they proceeded. I think that they could foresee that they might be chased by a police officer. I don't think that they could reasonably foresee that the Texas Department of Public Safety would get a helicopter involved and start raining bullets down on them. I don't think anyone in the state would foresee that, because I've never heard of a situation where a Texas Department of Public Safety helicopter or any other law enforcement helicopter in any point in time was used to disable a vehicle by shooting at it when deadly force wasn't authorized. And in point of fact, that's part of the unreasonable.
Well, Mr. Smith, so that went back to my question that I asked Mr. Heifel, very in line with Justice Tejerina just asked, is that if we look at how the state is wanting us to look at the intentional tort, then it doesn't matter who they shoot, whether it's illegal aliens in the back of a truck or whether it's a vehicle in a nearby, even though they took precautions to make sure there wasn't any other vehicles. But I specifically asked Mr. Heifel that if they had shot an innocent bystander, they would still be entitled to immunity. Is that what you understood his argument to be as well?
That is what I understand his argument to be.
So where do we draw the line as to what an intentional tort is? If we can't do what Mr. Heifel says, and I'm not saying that we can or cannot, or this court has decided in any way, that it is the intent of shooting a gun, which we all know can cause death, then what intent and what factors do we look at to decide whether this is an intentional tort by these officers?
I think that you can look at the case law that exists, you know, State Farm versus Fire and Casualty Company versus SS and Durbin and all these cases that define what an intentional tort is.
Tell me how Durbin helps you. Tell me what it is in Durbin that helps you.
So Durbin looked at a line of cases that was trying to determine what is not an intentional tort. And Durbin looked at the cases that had come before it. And in every single one of the cases where an intentional tort had been found, there was either a specific intent to cause injury or an intent to cause injury could be assumed based upon the conduct that took place. For example, a police officer involved in a pursuit, the pursuit vehicle winds up crashing out, police officer runs over like in Cabezos, and he pulls out his firearm, he points it into the driver's side vehicle and fires into the driver's side of the vehicle. Well, you don't have to get the police officer to testify, I intended to shoot the driver of the vehicle, because the facts that surround that circumstance supports that that was nothing but an intentional shooting of the driver. And the Texas Supreme Court cases that deal with this draw the line between negligence, recklessness, and an intentional tort between conduct that takes place with substantial certainty that the injury will result or with the intent that it will result. And you look at the context here, the Texas Department of Public Safety troopers who were involved in this shooting were not substantially certain that they were going to wind up killing a bystander or injuring a bystander who would be in the bed of that truck, because their universal consensus was that they had jumped to the conclusion that this truck was transporting narcotics and not people. It's our position that that assumption was straight running negligent, because this place and this area in South Texas is known for traffic violations, it's known for game violations, it's known for normal infractions, it's also known for the transport of narcotics, it's also known for the transport of human beings. And the testimony from the troopers and from the game wardens is that the experience down there is that it was not unusual for there to be trucks transporting people in the bed with a tarp or another blanket or a covering over them to conceal them from people who would be looking. When the troopers got here and they see a Hispanic guy driving a truck that has a tarp in the bed, and the reason why they conclude that it's drugs as opposed to people is because it seemed to be piled up closer to the cab, that's not a reasonable assumption that there are not people in the bed of that truck. Now, they're not substantially certain that there are. They didn't know that there were, but they jumped to that negligent conclusion that there was, and the risk that there would be in this area in South Texas was certainly foreseeable to them. And that foreseeability is negligence, not an intentional tort. Does that answer the court's question?
Yeah, so you want us to look, as I discussed with Mr. Heifel, the policy and the information that these officers knew or didn't know prior to them deciding whether to shoot the guns or not at this vehicle. And
there's a line of cases, Chin, the Ryan case that Mr. Heifel mentioned that we cite in our brief, case out of Washington, Kansas, where there is acknowledged where if there is a negligent misperception of fact that precedes the shooting, you can have a negligent cause of action that arises out of the same conduct that, even though it's an intentional shooting of a vehicle, where that shooting is based upon a negligent misperception of fact, that gives rise to a negligent cause of action.
Do we take into account, I'm sorry, do we take into, did you have a question, Ms. Justice Zahedi?
I did, and I wanted to, I just wanted to try to understand the difference between the negligence and an intentional tort. Under very similar circumstances, if there was a trooper on the ground or a deputy on the ground who intentionally deployed spike strips in the same circumstances, and then the not knowing there were other people in the vehicle, and if it flipped and killed, would that be somehow different?
No, it depends on what actually happens in the circumstances, because I think that the termination of what the cause of action is and whether or not it's an intentional tort or not is going to be necessarily a fact-based determination. So let's say it was the exact same situation that was here, okay? But instead of shooting down from the helicopter, the person, the law enforcement officer, the trooper was on the ground and had deployed spike strips. If everything is based upon the same thing that we know, then it becomes a question of what was foreseeable and what was substantially certain to accrue. And if it's foreseeable, take, for example, Deal, where the officer did deploy spike strips. I think that that could be negligence if there's a passenger in the vehicle that has caused injury by virtue of that deployment. Or another example, say that the DPS officers here had an errant shot that shot the driver of the vehicle, and the driver, by virtue of being injured, loses control and runs into one of the other vehicles on the road, kills the passengers. We would not say that arises out of a battery, or that the trooper Avila battered the passengers in that third-party vehicle. We would construe that as negligence based on what is foreseeable and what is not foreseeable.
Do we took into account, as I discussed with Mr. Heifel, that the policy has changed for the department after this incident?
I think you can, and you know, the idea that this policy was changed for some other reasons than this, well, we know that's not true, because the policy was announced by Director McCraw to the legislature in response to questioning about this very incident that occurred on October 25th, 2012, that deprived his officers of the ability to do what they did in this case.
But don't we then cause an issue, just as Mr. Heifel says, and no department will change its policy, is that if the mere changing of the policy gives rise that somehow the previous policy was negligence or wrong or whatever? Because I don't think that's the whole issue. We don't want them not to be able to change policy, nobody to change policy, if it isn't for the betterment of the state.
I agree with that, Your Honor. And I believe that where it becomes relevant is on the Declaratory Judgment Act claim, but I also believe it has some relevance to the official immunity claim, right? Not to whether or not the department was negligent in having this policy. I think that the question of negligence that arises from this incident is the use and authorization of this firearm generally for this purpose, but also as specifically authorized by Trooper Prince and Captain Holland in this incident based on what took place prior to the shooting. But when the Department of Public Safety comes in and asserts official immunity and asks whether or not its officers acted in good faith, then I think that the policy that exists now, as well as policies that are used by other departments, like the Texas Department of Parks and Wildlife, which does not allow officers to shoot at a vehicle absent an authorization for deadly force. I think those policies can be used as relevant evidence on whether or not the trooper acted in good faith, which is to say, whether or not they acted as an objectively prudent officer would have acted under the same or similar circumstances.
Does it matter that these officers knew that there's no evidence to say that these officers knew that there was anybody in the truck of the bed of this truck? I'm sorry. Does that make sense? Does it make any difference to the analysis of this case that the officers did not know that there was anybody in the bed of this truck?
I think it does. I think the question is, did they know and should they have taken into account the possibility?
Well, I understand the second portion, that you're making the argument is that they should have known, an assumption that they made that it was drugs and not people or other things is the wrong assumption, giving rise to the negligence. But right. Do we give them any, do we take into account that there's no evidence to show that they did know?
I believe that you do, because if they knew that there were people in the bed of the truck, it moves us into the situation where someone fires into a crowd, hoping that they hit nobody, but knowing that they're substantially certain that they're going to hit somebody. And I think that would move it into the realm of an intentional.
Counsel, is it undisputed that they did not know? Because I understand from reading some of the record that their feet were visible. I think there was some testimony from the surviving immigrants that there was some evidence that they had their feet sticking out. But, or is your position that the officers did not see anything?
Or is that did. I've watched that video dozens of times. I know that one of the occupants of the vehicle said their feet were sticking out at some point. I don't know if that happened when DPS showed up or if it was before DPS showed up. I know that at some point, for a fraction of a second, you can see a heat trace when the FLIR was activated on the camera, but it's not, you've got to watch that video over and over again and know what you're looking for to catch it. It is undisputed that the troopers did not know and that they assumed that this was drugs. That's not disputed, Your Honor.
And whether that's reasonable or not, that is an issue. But
it is.
It's very clear from the record then in your position that they would not have known that there were people back there.
I don't believe they did know. I think given the area where this occurred, they should have known and should have considered the possibility. Like the testimony from Officer from the game warden Whitworth and Moore, they didn't jump to a conclusion about what was in the bed of the truck because of the kinds of infractions that take place. It could have been drugs, it could have been people, it could have been a deer that had been illegally shot, or it could have been something completely innocent. And they didn't draw any conclusion about what was in the bed of the truck until the pursuit came to a stop and they got to the bed of the truck and looked inside. That was the whole purpose of the game wardens starting the pursuit, was so that they could take a look and see what was underneath the tarp in the bed of the truck. I want to address quickly the issue of the negligent trust, because I think that there's two different issues here. I don't think that the Rangel case addresses what is negligent entrustment. The Rangel case says that when you have a state agency or you have a supervisory officer who authorizes the action in the specific circumstances, that is in itself a use of tangible personal property on the part of the state. And so there's not any discussion in Rangel on whether or not the trooper who fired that scat shell that was only intended to be used outdoors was incompetent or not incompetent. The question is whether or not the authorization to use that shell was in itself negligence. The issue of negligent entrustment is something entirely different. And in that respect, you have two different kinds of claims that can be asserted, whether or not DPS's authorization of the use of this firearm to disable the vehicle and Captain Holland and Lieutenant Prince's authorization to use the firearm to disable the vehicle in this incident was negligent, and whether or not DPS negligently entrusted this personal property, the helicopter and the firearm, to these troopers for the purpose of when it knew or should have known that that was negligent. And I want to address quickly, because this wasn't raised in the trial court, and Mr. Heifel brings it up in his reply brief, that there's no evidence that DPS knew or should have known that it would be negligent to entrust this helicopter and the firearm to these troopers. And with that respect, I mean, DPS knew that these troopers were authorized to use this firearm to disable a vehicle without regard to the circumstances and whether or not deadly force was authorized. And they also should have known that Captain Holland, 6 months before this happened, was on national television bragging about how we're not giving up one square inch of territory down in South Texas, and you're going to see weapons and tactics that are only used in war zones. When your trooper, who's in charge of this helicopter, is bragging 6 months before the incident about war zone tactics and weaponry, you should not be giving that person charge over a helicopter and a LaRue OBR 308 caliber firearm with a silencer on the end of it.
Okay, Mr. Smith, your time is up. Unless there's any further questions from either Justice Tahini or Justice Hinojosa. Thank you for time. Thank you for participating in our Zoom hearings. And we will allow Mr. Heifel his 5 minutes of rebuttal at this time before we conclude today's oral argument.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Your Honor. I'd like to begin by touching on the declaratory relief that the plaintiffs asked for and that Mr. Smith mentioned. The trial court lacked jurisdiction to grant that relief. The first reason is that the plaintiffs lack standing. Here again, I want to be clear about what DPS is arguing. We're not in any way denying the injury that the decedents suffered, but instead the question is live controversy and redressability. The plaintiffs have not sought an injunction, and in their briefing, they concede that the declarations they asked for would not entitle them to damages. The declarations are not connected to a claim for monetary relief. So the declarations can't redress their injury. And there's a line of cases that help us understand why they don't have standing. First, in Ashcroft versus Mattis from the US Supreme Court, there was a young man that was shot and killed by police. The father sought a declaration that the officers had acted unconstitutionally. And that's completely understandable. But the US Supreme Court held that that need to know whether the action was unconstitutional and the emotional satisfaction that the family member would have from being vindicated by the court held that that's not sufficient to create standing. And later the US Supreme Court cited that in Lyons, which is the chokehold case. And relying on Lyons, the Texas Supreme Court in Williams versus Lara held that the plaintiffs lacked standing to pursue declaratory relief because they could not show that it was likely that they would again be subject to the allegedly unconstitutional behavior. Now, the plaintiffs could have brought a Section 1983 suit against the officers that were involved in this incident. That may not have succeeded because of qualified immunity, but the plaintiffs would not have had the standing problems that they have in this suit. And the US Supreme Court discusses that option in Lyons, and the Texas Supreme Court discusses it in Williams versus Lara. The second reason is that the UDJA does not waive immunity here. The UDJA does not contain a general waiver of sovereign immunity. It does contain a limited waiver for the challenge to the constitutionality of a statute or a municipal ordinance, but that's it. And the Austin Court of Appeals and Coleman and other cases has held that the UDJ does not waive immunity for a challenge to an agency rule or policy, and the Fort Worth Court of Appeals has agreed. That makes sense, Your Honors, because of the plain language of the statute itself. The UDJA expressly mentions challenges to statute or ordinance. It never mentions anything about a challenge to a departmental rule or policy. And I'd like to go back briefly to Durbin, which Mr. Smith spoke about. Durbin, Your Honor, relies on Reed Tool. Reed Tool was a Texas Supreme Court case. It was in the workers' comp context. And there the court said that the way we distinguish an intentional tort from negligence is the intentional intent to cause injury. But the problem for the plaintiffs is that in Gordon, the Texas Supreme Court explicitly discusses the Reed Tool line of cases and says that in the context of the Tort Claims Act, that doesn't apply because the desire to the intent to cause injury is not an essential element of a battery. And the court even went so far to say that contact that is intended to help or please the plaintiff can still constitute a battery as long as a reasonable person would find it to be offensive. Mr. Smith also touched on the use of spikes. The record indicates that the officers considered that option here. They put out a radio call for any officers in the area to see if anyone was available to deploy the spikes, and they never heard back. So the only thing that they could assume is that there were no officers in the area who could help. Again, the choice that they were facing was allow the game wardens to continue the pursuit into school zones in the afternoon, or use the means that were available to them in the safest way that they knew how to disable the vehicle. At least some reasonable officer, maybe not every reasonable officer, but some reasonable officer could decide that they made the correct decision. There are no further questions. We would ask that the court reverse the trial court's order and render judgment dismissing the case.
All right, any further questions from Justice Hinojosa or Justice Tejerina? Then the court will stand in recess until further. Thank you, Ms.